Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're all very welcome. Dermot MacDonald with you this morning. Our newspaper panel have been busy picking the best and the rest from this morning's newspapers. But before I introduce them to you, let's have a quick look at what is making the headlines this morning. It's a really mixed bag, actually, with the budget, the passenger cap at Dublin Airport, the threat of drones at all of our airports, and alleged abuses of Ireland's child allowance scheme all vying for space on the front pages. And don't worry, there is plenty more coverage of the fallout between last year's former referenda allies, Maria Steen and Michael McDowell, which continues to attract lots of colour and commentary, as well as extensive debate about the path to nomination for presidential candidates. Ministers rule out income tax in the budget. That's the lead story for the Sunday Times, with Jennifer Bray reporting that the vast majority of workers will face disappointment in the forthcoming budget with little or no change to their take-home pay. Jennifer Bray writes about a series of key battles that are still raging in the government ahead of the budget, which is due to be unveiled on October 7th, not far now. Dublin Airport set to get special status to lift mad passenger cap. That's the splash for the Business Post, which says that the public interest will override local objections to grow capacity at the airport from the current number of 32 million to over 40 million passengers a year. The Sunday Independent also leads with an airport-related story, with a warning by military experts that Irish airports could face disruption from a wave of escalating drone attacks. That warning comes after unidentified drones closed five Danish airports last week. The Sunday Independent's front page carries an image of former presidential hopeful Maria Steen and her husband Neil Steen, photographed at their home in Dublin yesterday. Mrs. Steen, in a first-person piece inside of the paper, describes weeks of being ghosted by Mr. McDowell, as well as certain unnamed Oireachtas members who, she said, left her text and emails unanswered. "The reality is there was more than enough time for anyone who wanted to nominate me to do so," she said. "While I would never presume on anyone's vote and no one had an obligation to nominate me, I did appreciate the candour of those who met with me and told me, one way or another, whether they intended to nominate me or not." The Irish Mail on Sunday leads with a report of alleged abuses of Ireland's child allowance scheme, as TUSLA conducts more than 40,000 welfare checks on children in the wake of two high-profile child deaths. And amid speculation that the BBC could air the Irish version of The Traitors, the company behind the Runaway series predicts that Irish stars such as Paddy, Eamon and Owen could be tipped for world fame if the Irish series travels beyond these shores. The splash in the Sunday World is McGregor pal in festival drug bust. Patrick O'Connell, in a report named labelled as an exclusive, reports that James Lawrence, the man sued alongside Conor McGregor by Nikita Hand in a civil action for rape, has paid €300 to a court poor box in exchange for having a charge of possessing MDMA at the Electric Picnic Festival dismissed. Mr. Lawrence faced a single charge of possessing a small quantity of MDMA or ecstasy at the festival two years ago. Most of today's papers cover the discovery of an adult child, found dead, as you heard in the bulletin, believed to be a father and daughter who were found dead in the Kappa area of Finglas yesterday. It's the lead for the Irish Sunday Mirror. Across the Irish Sea, lots and lots of debate about the fate of Keir Starmer on the eve of the Labour Party conference. And the Sunday Telegraph has, like many of today's papers in the UK, a striking image of England players celebrating their Rugby World Cup win at Twickenham in front of a record crowd. "English roses rule the world" is the headline there. Now, doing all the hard work this morning so you don't have to, with me now in studio are Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister of State for European Affairs; Bobby McDonough, former ambassador to the UK, EU and Italy; Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News with Mediahouse Ireland; and Dr. Barra Rowntree, economist at Trinity College, which I have to say, resplendent in your Steelers outfit ahead of the big NFL game today. I wonder, for balance, whether I should have worn a Vikings one, just in case. Kevin Doyle, I'm going to start with you. Gary Murphy says, "It could have been so different. Steen versus Michael Flatley, Conor McGregor versus Bob Geldof, Gareth Sheridan versus Joanna Donnelly, and other sort of things, had it not been for the case that the presidential process closed today. And it has come under scrutiny since Wednesday. Not for the first time, it has to be said. Maria Steen and Gareth Sheridan were close but neither managed to get across the line. Maria Steen had 90%, 18 of those all-important Oireachtas members. Talk us through those final frantic hours. I imagined that if Netflix were doing, like, in the writer's room, a series, those kind of final hours of trying to get a nomination across the line would be ripe pickings.
It does have a little bit of that kind of West Wing, Mad Men, movers and shakers kind of stuff happening behind the scenes. I don't know if Netflix would commission it, to be honest, Derval. But it comes down to the fact that she was two votes short, and there is now a blame game going on about the people who could have given her those two votes. And I do get a sense that there's kind of two arguments in the papers today. And look, let's be honest, there is almost universal agreement among all the columnists that they wish Maria Steen was in the presidential race. And that may be for their own purposes, because it would have given them great colour. I mean, you know, there is actually an election underway which she's not in, and yet she is the dominant picture and voice in the papers today. She writes her own piece in the Sunday Independent, because we had had kind of various versions of events, and a lot of people focusing on Michael McDougall because they worked together so well and so effectively on the referendum for care and family last year. Do you think, Kevin, there was, to use the
legal phrase, a rebuttable presumption that having worked so closely, despite not being aligned on other issues, but having worked so closely on the referendums last year, that there was a presumption that he would give her the nod?
There was a sense, certainly I think in the political ranks, that if she got as close as she did ultimately, that yes, the pressure would be such that people like Michael McDougall would come on board. Look, it's a little bit like saying...
They were unlikely allies in some respects.
Oh, totally unlikely allies. I mean, you know, his economics is maybe to the right, but he is quite socially open on things. So I don't think they were ever seen as being the same kind of political track, or they would never land in the same political party. But there was kind of this sense of, well, if somebody runs 90% of a marathon, you might give them a lift for the last 10 if they start to slow up. And that was the presumption. But I think it was kind of a naivety. And look, she says in the piece that she learned a lot about politics this week.
She also says, over the course of the next 3 weeks, right up until the close of the nominations on September 24th, my calls, texts and emails went unanswered. And she is very clear. She says, I should say that he, i.e. Michael McDougall, was not the only politician not to respond.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just rude. Let's be honest about it. I don't see why he couldn't have just told her it's not happening and stop calling. I think that would have been a simple enough thing. But I think part of what has happened here is if you look at one of the candidates who is in the race, who has repeatedly faced questions about having nominated somebody 7 years ago, and their name has been attached to that other person, and they're trying to make the argument that I just gave them a nomination. I just gave them a way of getting on the ticket. But actually, if you get someone into the presidential race, it is a huge platform, whether or not they win it.
Do you think that the question between the difference between a nomination and an endorsement is sort of a question of degree as much as
kind? I think it's a little bit blurred, you know, when it boils down to it at the end of the day, because you are responsible for giving that person a platform. So you take the Peter Casey example from 2018. You know, very few people knew who Peter Casey was, and suddenly he turned that entire presidential race on topics that none of us in the media, or I suspect in politics, had expected would be part of it, around travellers' issues, around migration, things like that. And it's a huge platform, and this time there are much less candidates. So if Maria Steen had ended up in the race, we would absolutely be debating topics that I can confidently say we will not now be debating. And that might be a good thing, you could argue, but for someone like Michael McDougall, who's going, well, my name will be attached in some way to having given her that platform, I can see why he may have been reticent to do that.
Lucinda, you had a look at that piece, which is headlined, I learned a lot about politics last week and I'm not giving up on it just yet.
Yeah, I suppose it gives the perspective of Maria Steen and perhaps a little insight into how it played out, which is interesting and useful. It's not an angry piece. It's not sort of apportioning blame, but at the same time, it sort of, I suppose, spells out her experience and why she was frustrated by the process. And I agree with Kevin. I mean, I think, you know, when you are an elected member of the Oireachtas and you have this unique power, as do the county councils. And there were a very limited number, actually, of sort of serious candidates. Really, it came down to Maria Steen and Gavin Sheridan as the only two that had any prospect of getting onto the ballot paper. It is rude not to meet with them, and particularly when you've worked closely with somebody, very closely with somebody, to not offer an explanation. That's just bizarre to me.
And look, I mean, listen to Maria Steen achieved a lot in a very, very short period of time. And I know she describes that sort of that frantic kind of month, you know, you're trying to keep an eye on the county councils and your opportunities there. But, you know, to even have amassed 90% of, you know, the votes.
It's incredible.
Required.
Yeah. I thought what was really interesting was, you know, the reasoning of people like Marion Harkin, who, you know, spent, I think, three terms in the European Parliament as a Liberal MEP. And, you know, who clearly wouldn't have been, well, I assume wouldn't have been voting for Maria Steen. But, you know, but I thought articulated very well her logic in providing her signature to nominate Maria Steen, which was simply to ensure that there was adequate debate in this campaign. And that, you know, those who have a different viewpoint, which I presume is a minority viewpoint, would have that aired in the campaign. And that's good for democracy. And what we are going to see now is, in a diminished field, we had seven candidates the last time. You may not love all of them. Actually, it was a really vibrant, I'm talking about the last real election we had in 2011. You had a range of voices. You had David Norris. Actually, Shane Ross has a piece today talking about how he was committed to support Michael D. Higgins on that occasion.
And then he rang Michael D. and said, actually, I'm going to give my
David
nomination.
Norris asked him for his support just to get on the ballot paper, and he didn't hesitate. I think, you know, this is a unique election in terms of there are only really two sort of sets of gatekeepers, the Oireachtas members and the county councils. And both, I think, have fallen down. And I think they have actually let down democracy. It's not about the individuals,
it's about the process. For a very, very long time, when we've had political reform around the presidency in the past, we've voted on the age of the presidency, and which the Irish public didn't want anyone under 35. You know, we've looked at sort of the term for it. But Gary Murphy, in his piece this morning, is even Hermes couldn't help Steen bag a nomination. But he says the reason we don't have any fantasy presidential battles is because candidates need to show some spot of public support, and ultimately she didn't have enough. And the same could be applied to Gareth Sheridan.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, we should have a bar to this. It shouldn't be anyone can put their name forward for the presidency. I mean, all you need to do is take a look at some of the madcap set of candidates who are going to the county councils. I think there was reports of one person dressed as a wheelbarrow going to the city council, Dublin City Council one. So right, you need some bar somewhere, right? That there has to be a bar. It can't be just anyone nominates themselves. 10%, less than 10% of the members of the Oireachtas isn't a particularly onerous burden, right? You've got 20 out of more than 200 between the Shannon and the Dáil. And four local authorities, again, isn't that particularly arduous. So I find it hard to kind of think that.
Well, it is if there's abstentions, and it is if one of the main parties has said.
It's still in terms of, you know, it's not like there is a large swathe of people who voted, who have more than 20 representatives in the House of Oireachtas who could have signed this person's nomination form. I think we need to draw a line somewhere. The idea that we're talking about having, and as has been proposed, a referendum on changing this, on changing the bar, because that's set out in the Constitution, I think is again a bit mad.
Bobby, what do you think? I know you had a look at Maria's piece herself in the Sunday Independent this morning.
Like a lot of things, I don't see this as a black and white issue. Sometimes in politics, people see it as such. I think she would have been an articulate candidate and would have spiced up the debate. And I think she represents a clear segment of the electorate. Although I personally would emphasise she absolutely does not represent all Catholics. I mean, as a Catholic, I know there are many others who prefer to support one of the other candidates. And I do understand the reasoning of somebody like Marion Harkin, as Lucinda says, that who doesn't support the candidate but did nominate her. But on the other hand, and that tends marginally, I suppose, to be my view, is we do have provisions in the Constitution for a reason. They've been there since 1937. And the provision of a threshold really only makes sense if TDs and senators and councillors and the political parties they belong to are free to make up their own minds. And that includes Michael McDowell, whether or not he should have responded to the telephone
messages. And Maria Steen acknowledges that herself in the piece. You're saying, you know, she doesn't make any presumptions about any vote. And presumably the right and that you have to nominate someone also applies to the opposite. You have a right not to.
Exactly. And I would just use two other words. Jeremy Corbyn. We have to remember that Jeremy Corbyn was nominated to lead the Labour Party by people who didn't support him and they didn't think he would win. I'm not suggesting, I think, that Maria Steen would have won. But it just does show the risk of making a distinction between who you nominate and who you support, because the election of Jeremy Corbyn had enormous consequences for the Labour Party and indeed for Brexit, because he didn't come out on that issue as he should have done. So there
and
are risks involved.
Kevin, David Quinn, who describes himself as a friend of Maria Steen, he was writing this morning saying, politicians are scared of us voters, so they denied Steen a chance, and sort of leaning into that, look at how well Peter Casey did in the last election. Do you think that there was a fear that had Maria Steen successfully gotten the ballot that she would have done much better than expected?
Yeah, well, I don't think you have to be a political anorak or an academic to know that in kind of non-governmental elections, there is often a backlash against the government or the establishment, in inverted commas. And I suppose the point David Quinn is making here is that did Micheál Martin, Simon Harris, Mary Lou MacDonald fear that by allowing somebody like Maria Steen on the ticket that there is that much volatility at the moment, that voters can swing from left to right on different issues. And let's be honest, presidential campaigns can go in any direction, as we know from the 2011 one. So were they worried that maybe she just becomes this firebrand that people get behind and that knocks their candidates out of the way? And then they end up with a very uncomfortable president in the Oras. You know, for Michael D, the government are often asked about Michael D as a, you know, does he cross the line? Does his public pronouncements go too far? But actually, I think, and if you look at Leo Varadkar talked about it in his book, and that his relationship with Michael D is actually very cordial. He takes advice from him. He rates him as a serious politician with serious experience. You know, hard to see Micheál Martin going up to Áras an Uachtaráin every 6 weeks to, you know, chin stroke with Maria Steen and get advice on how things are going in the country. So that's kind of David Quinn's point, is that the volatility among voters is probably what's scaring the main parties.
And just in terms of, you know, the portioning of the blame, Lucinda Creighton, what Maria Steen says in her piece is that she felt that the Oireachtas route was or should have been a more viable option. She'd already discounted the parties and TDs and senators who were running their own candidates. She knew that they weren't going to support her. But Shane Ross is spreading the blame a little bit more. He's saying, look, it wasn't just, you know, he said it wasn't just, you know, Michael McDowell and others, but he is actually also pointing the finger at Michael Lowry and others.
Yeah, and I mean, like for independent members of the Oireachtas, you know, he makes the point, I think, about a sort of a magical spell which Michael Lowry and Michael McDowell have over their flock. So not all that independent, necessarily.
Well, I'm sure they would say that they are absolutely entitled to make up their own minds in respect
of
their vote.
Of course they can. Of course they can. But the point is that they almost have a sort of an informal whip system. And when, you know, certain independents went to ground and wouldn't return phone calls, their followers followed the same sort of course of action. And yeah, I simply think everybody's free to make up their mind. But, you know, as an elected member of the Oireachtas, you probably have a duty to at least engage and, you know, and discuss and sort of weigh up and give the person the
sort of the purported ghosting, I think, that Maria Steen had a difficulty with when people weren't, you know, returning calls and messages.
Look, I mean, Mike McDowell isn't here to explain why he didn't respond. Personally, if I got a call from Conor McGregor, I wouldn't respond. Now, I'm not equating Maria Steen with Conor McGregor, but look, you know, there could be reasons for it. But personally, one thing I hope is, first of all, that there won't be a boycott of the election. There's a reference in the papers today, people saying they won't vote. I think that would be an extremely negative and unfortunate thing and would achieve nothing. But I also think it's really important that the very negative social media attacks on people who were supporting Maria Steen, and she had absolutely nothing to do with it, I would emphasise that, but I hope that sort of negativity in the social media will not continue.
Negative attacks on people
campaign.
Who wouldn't support her rather than the ones who would
support her. But I do hope that doesn't continue during the presidential campaign.
Kevin, I just ask you, you know, sometimes people say, well, no response is a response, but just perhaps because there wasn't as much engagement, that doesn't mean that individual TDs and senators did not reflect deeply on their decision, given, as you say, there was a lot of pressure from some supporters of Maria Steen, you know, in terms of targeting those TDs and senators who hadn't made up their minds.
Yeah, well, I won't name names, but I know some of them that actually drove them away from it. The fact that they became the focus of dozens of emails, of social media commentary and kind of a consorted campaign, which Maria Steen says was not her doing, obviously people who wanted her on the ticket were driving it, but not her. And I think that did make people uncomfortable because they're imagining, well, what might this be like in an election campaign when it becomes even more heated? There's no doubt, Derval, that people did think about this. They did reflect on it. You know, Michael Healy-Ray initially indicated that he wouldn't. And then as time went on, he obviously changed his mind. So,
while saying, I'm supporting Heather Humphreys, but I'm...
Yeah, so it does show that, you know, while people might have told Maria Steen 3 weeks out that, no, I'm sorry, can't do that, people did change their mind. So it is worth that second phone call and that third phone call right up to the last hour, you know?
Yeah, I think ultimately, I totally agree with Bobby's point. It would be really regrettable if there were, and it appears there may be, a concerted sort of spoil your vote campaign. I think that's a terrible idea, and I really hope that doesn't transpire. But I think it's absolutely inevitable now that the turnout in this election is going to be very low, probably historically low.
Well,
I think that's really unfortunate.
Let me bring
it's
you
not
then
good for democracy, and that is the fundamental point here.
Kevin Doyle, let me bring you then, because we are in official election mode. We have three nominees: Catherine Connolly, Jim Gavin, and Heather Humphreys. The campaign officially began this week. Talk us through how the week has gone so far.
Well, I think five days into the formal campaign, and we have to give them all equal shot now, is we've probably learned more about what their Achilles heels are or their weaknesses are than their strengths. If you look at them, let's take them maybe one by one. You know, Catherine Connolly has had a go at the Brits, a go at the Americans, the Germans, the French. And the president, a big part of that role is to represent us internationally. So she has very strong worldview on countries that we would consider friendly countries. And if she's going to talk about that during the campaign, she's going to have to defend that and explain to people who would be more moderate in that why her way is fine. So I think that's the challenge she's already laid out for herself. If you look at Heather Humphreys, she's having to wear a decade in government. So she's getting asked about the housing crisis. You know, Michael D. Higgins used language like disaster. Heather Humphreys is only willing to use language like a challenge. So she's trying to spin that as, I have loads of experience. Political experience matters for this job, but she's going to get more and more of that as time goes on and people looking at her record in government. And then Jim Gavin, the kind of great unknown, and that's actually a problem for him.
Whose campaign launch, I think, is underway this morning.
Yes, so maybe today we'll learn a little bit more, but it's still unclear why Jim Gavin is running for president and why now. You know, he's talked a lot about shining light on different issues. A lot of people have said, well, you had a high profile. You were the manager of one of the most successful sporting teams in this country ever. You could easily have spoke out on lots of issues and people would have listened to you, but you chose not to. So I think part of the challenge for Jim Gavin is trying to convince people.
And we'll get a first brush. Is it the first televised debate is
Monday
tomorrow
night?
Monday night. Yeah.
So we'll see them all up close. And that will be interesting because it'll even be interesting to see. Transfers are going to decide this election one way or the other, and so it'll be interesting to see how they interact with each other, how far they push points against each other, or if they literally stand on those three podiums and just try to talk about themselves.
And finally, just before we go to a break, just picking up on something Lucinda said, what is your prediction for turnout?
Oh, I think it's low. I think the spoil the vote, I don't know if it'll be the spoil the vote. I suspect it'll be more in the space of no turnout, because there is now, for better or worse, whether it was Maria Steen or somebody else, there is a side of the political debate that is not catered for on that ticket. It goes from, you could argue, centre-right to, depending how far left you believe Catherine Connolly is, but there is definitely a section over there that are not... don't see anybody in the paper that represents them.
Okay, well, on that, we'll take a quick break. You're all very welcome back. With me are Lucinda Creighton, Bobby McDonagh, Kevin Doyle and Dr. Barra Rowntree. Barra, you've been looking at the coverage of Budget 26 across the papers today. I know you were writing about it in the Irish Times yesterday. Thoughts?
It's been framed as, we're paring things back now, and now that the election has been and gone, and we, you know, spent lots of money in advance of that. But it's really not being pared back that much. We're still talking about an exceptionally large increase in spending once you factor in the tax cuts that they're also planning. So over the last few years, it's been, if you look at permanent measures, so ignoring all the supposedly once-off, which then became temporary, and now are being phased out this year, spending and net of tax cuts was increasing by about 10% permanent spending a year on average over the last 5 years. This year it's going down to 6.5%.
That's if they actually stick to their plans, which, again, they haven't done in many years, right? So we could end up actually not seeing it so different from previous years. And it's also, I mean, there's no real signs, again, other than the spin from the Ministers for Finance and Public Expenditure, that this is somehow prudent. It really is not. And we had this week,
they're saying we're practicing restraint. We are practicing restraint.
Very much. It's, you know, give me prudence, but not just yet is kind of what comes to mind. But
they're under pressure at the same time,
oh,
too.
Oh, absolutely. And then, again, like there is, I think, it is true also that they're on the more prudent end in the Oireachtas, but that's not to say that anyone is prudent.
And does the opposition bear responsibility for that too?
Some as well. But I think fundamentally what the issue here is, like, I think there is general agreement across the political, at least the political spectrum represented in the Oireachtas, and again, kind of maybe come back to that. But there is general agreement that we need more spending on, I think, pretty much everyone's agreed on infrastructure. We're just way behind on that, and we had a decade of lost infrastructure spending. So we need to catch up on that. A lot of people want more spending on public services, childcare, health, education. People making the case for that in the papers, and that's fine. If we think that that's something we want to do, then that's good. But let's not cut taxes then at the same time. I think there fundamentally has to be a decision made here. And if you look at what's, again, if over the last few budgets, the successive governments have ended up cutting off around what amounts to more than $3.5 billion in tax revenues through cuts to the USC and the property tax, which they've pretended aren't real cuts. But they have. They've gradually eroded the tax base. They've chipped away at inheritance tax, capital acquisitions tax as well. We're talking about VAT. We're talking about a really expensive cut. And for me, the most worrying thing about that is they're saying that, well, actually, we'll make it half as expensive if we only do it halfway through the year.
This is the VAT and the, as see, Pat McDonough is given out about it in the Sunday Business Post, by saying, well, if we don't start on the 1st of January and leave it to next June or July, well, then it won't feel so bad.
But which is nonsense. And it will cost over $600 million each year thereafter, right? And it's being proposed on the basis that, oh, well, we've said we'd do a $1.4 billion tax package. This costs over $600 billion, but if we only started halfway through the year, it'll only cost $300 billion. That's just enumerate. I think the measure is ridiculous. I think it's economically illiterate, but it's enumerate to pretend that it doesn't cost that money.
And I'll get to that in just a moment. But Kevin, just what Barr was saying there, you know, the cry of the emergency leads to temporary crude measures that then we become familiar with and accustomed to very, very quickly. And even though, you know, I think somebody was saying in the paper today that, you know, Ireland is a rich country that for many feels poor. So people will miss those one-off supports that have characterised the last number of budgets.
There's a word, and I think I found it in the Sunday Independent, the Sunday Times and the Sunday Business Post today, which I haven't seen and talked about in a long time, austerity. That this budget might have a feel of austerity, even though what Barra is talking about there is spending the guts of $10 billion again. But because we're losing all those one-off measures, that people will feel like this is a cut at them, that they're not getting as much as they were last year. And that's the real short-termism of what we've been doing with budgets. We're talking about this prudence, but look, everybody loves a tax cut. And there's this kind of an attempt to keep all of the people happy all of the time. And as a result, it all gets spread very thin. And everybody's a little bit annoyed, to be honest, because, oh, carers only got this much. Oh, childcare only got this much. Oh, workers only got this much. And we are at a time of pretty much full employment. So, you know, we talk about the multinationals. What if one of them pulled out or Trump does something? And you could also just say, what if unemployment went up a little bit? Like, what if the economy just naturally slowed down a little bit and suddenly not everybody who wanted a job had a job, and you're paying more in social welfare and having less tax coming in? Like, it's not going to take a huge big bang moment for this to go a little bit different. So, you know, it's a strange budget. I was talking to a minister yesterday who was suggesting that the news value of this budget will die in about 12 hours. So they're really trying to play it down.
And there is a sense that it's quite quiet in terms of, you know, the usual kind of run up and the flyers and everything. Listen to Creighton, there was another word which tiptoed back into the papers this morning, which was troika.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say.
A new troika that Shane Coleman is getting very concerned, but is saying, look, basically, the central bank, IFAC, which was obviously introduced to ensure that we wouldn't get into overspending or inflating the economy again. But he was saying the new troika, there's a new troika in town, but it's not been listened to.
It's toothless, unfortunately. Yeah. And I was going to say, when you mentioned austerity, like, obviously, I was a minister in the government where we had to implement/impose, you know, the worst austerity that the state has ever experienced. And that was grueling and gruesome and horrific. And I would argue that, you know, the decisions taken then laid the foundations for the economic prosperity and recovery that we have experienced since. And it is really worrying.
Many would also argue that it also led to that sort of increasing wealth gap between those with a lot of money and those less so.
I mean, we could probably talk all day about some of the poor policy decisions that have been taken in the intervening 10 or 12 years. And when you look at, I mean, so yes, this troika, ESRI, Central Bank of Ireland, IFAC, it was the end of our government that established the Fiscal Advisory Council. The purpose was to ensure that this would never, ever happen again. Those words were repeated endlessly by my colleagues, myself at that time. And it is really disturbing to see just how glibly IFAC is ignored every year. I think Seamus Coffey is a phenomenal servant to the state, actually, in terms of his, you know, consistent articulation of what needs to happen and just repeatedly being ignored. It's really frustrating.
Bobby McDonagh, to the extent that the warnings may be ignored, is that just because of the realpolitik?
Yeah, I tend to agree with the other three panellists here. What should be done is relatively clear. As Jean-Claude Juncker said, European governments all know what to do, but they just don't know how to get elected after they've done it. And I do think that, you know, there is a real issue about democracy, that governments have to face the next election. So it makes it very hard for them to do what they need to do. But it's all about trade-offs. And money that's spent on one thing can't be spent on another. Tax cuts means there'll be less money to spend. And against that background, I agree broadly with Barra. I think that the two priorities should be infrastructure and targeted measures, because the more you give something to everybody, the less there is for those who really need it. So I'm not at all an expert on this, but personally, I'd like to see more emphasis on child poverty, vulnerable families, disability supports, and cost of living supports given through the welfare system.
And Barra, look, I mean, it's sort of become a bit of a mantra, you know, around, you know, budget time, you know, targeted supports versus broad measures. You know, we all know sort of the script by the time it gets to this time of the year. But particularly some of those measures and around VAT, I'd say Pat McDonough from Supermax is, you know, saying leave us out of the kind of the clampdown on it. But there's a lot of discussion about the VAT on hospitality just because of the sheer percentage it would consume of the overall tax budget.
Yeah, and it is a really expensive move. And again, it's been now framed as, oh, it'll save jobs. How many tens of thousands per job is that going to be? Like, there's no estimates of how many jobs it might save. We're just being told that, oh, it's very important for employment. And so, again, I think you really have to question. And this makes me maybe a little bit go against something Bobby said in terms of, you know, we don't know how to get re-elected afterwards. There's no political popularity in this VAT measure. If you look at the polling that's been done on it, it's really deeply unpopular, particularly if it means that there's less to go around elsewhere. But yet, it seems to be because it was made as a pre-election promise out in the stump by the Taoiseach and then turned into a solemn commitment, which he elevated himself.
It's kind of an interesting contrast. There's a piece, I think, by John Ireland this Sunday. The thesis in both pieces are the same. John Ireland, the Sunday Times, I think, is talking about the risks of overheating the economy. And then Shane Coleman is talking about us heading for a bust at some point as well. But in his piece, John Isle identifies a couple of restaurants that have closed recently as evidence that hospitality is in crisis.
Gasmith, Big Mike's and Black Rock is one of them. He's also, you know, they're saying that, I think what John Isle was saying is that throughout the country, hospitality businesses have struggled mightily despite a strong economy, rising wages and consumer spending.
And then if you read Shane Coleman's piece in the Sunday Business Post, Shane Coleman is citing the fact that restaurants are full every night of the week and the airport is full every day of the week.
And employment is up and there's more restaurants.
There are a couple of points here. I mean, one is that, you know, back again, or looking back to the financial crisis, there was a lot of criticism of corporate welfare, you know, and in that context, it was about the banks, it was about other institutions. And now we're looking at a different type of corporate welfare. Like, at the end of the day, we do have a booming economy, we have full employment. And at some point, you have to say, well, you know, businesses, not to name any individual businesses have to be able to compete, they have to be nimble, they have to be
viable.
So it's
part of the system. If you're not viable, go
to
the wall.
They have to be viable. They have to be profitable. And, you know, while you've mentioned some businesses that have closed, there are an awful lot of businesses open. There's a big, big piece somewhere today about a new rooftop restaurant in Dublin City Centre.
Another on piece the site about a 2 million renovation of a...
site of the old Central Bank. There are restaurants and cafes popping up all the time. So, you know, there is an issue about nimbleness here. And every other business, by the way, is experiencing... the cost of employment, the
energy,
cost of insurance,
auto
the cost of
energy.
Like, there are a lot of structural changes that need to happen in our economy that would definitely make it easier to run a business and more profitable to run
Burr,
a business.
Can I just bring you actually in that John Isle piece, and he is, you know, speaking about Seamus Coffey and IFAC, and he said that, you know, windfall taxes from the multinational sector and strong tax revenue from a growing economy are masking fundamental fiscal weaknesses. Yeah. And he calculates that although our headline tax revenue is stronger, that the underlying deficit is of 8 billion. And he says if we were hit by a shock now, it would have an outsized effect on Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. We're hugely exposed here. And it is, from that point of view, incredibly worrying how reliant we are on these corporation tax receipts. So, and what's also staggering is, despite what has been a remarkably strong economic recovery over the last few years, and again, people maybe aren't feeling that because of inflation, but generally the economy is doing very, very strongly. But we haven't run, actually, if you strip out the corporation tax receipts, a surplus over that entire time. Yeah. And so if we're not doing it now, when are we going to do it? And again, in terms of that underlying risk that people have been bellowing about since 2015, at least. Mm. I mean, you're talking about, it was a piece, I think, in the Sunday Business Post today pointing out that, you know, there's about 8 billion in receipts which come from pharmaceutical companies. And we're, okay, we're exposed there, maybe not so much in the tariffs, but if Trump strong arms them to move production back, that could hit us in the long run. It's also going to hit FDI. But, you know, also there's an issue around the prices of drugs in the US. They are much more expensive.
Legitimate.
There's a completely legitimate reason to cut the price of drugs in the US. If they do, that's going to hit pharmaceutical profits, which is our corporation tax. And so we're so, so reliant. I think it's about 75% now of revenues from corporation tax come from 10 companies, and most of that from just three. Like, we are exceptionally reliant on these corporation tax receipts. We hope they don't disappear. We hope they keep going. But we have ramped up spending on the back of it. And and the bit that worries me most, and Jed Nash was making this point in the Mail on Sunday, is that we're eroding the rest of the tax base. So I think we have to make our choices. Is it that we want to increase infrastructure spending and also increase public services spending? In which case, that's going to mean we're paying more tax.
So, Bobby McDonagh, does that mean the battle lines that are being drawn that Jennifer Bray in the Sunday Times is discussing in detail today are kind of... not quite meaningless, but in the overall big scale of things that we need to achieve, perhaps the reason why Kevin says it doesn't really feel like much running up to this budget?
I think you're probably right there in that the broad parameters of the budget have been agreed informally by the government at this stage, and they're working out the detail. You know, the sort of advice from the ESRI to be much more cautious is not going to be implemented in this occasion. I mean, I just wonder what Kevin thinks about public opinion in this context, because, you know, Barr's talking an awful lot of sense about what really is in the interests of the Irish people in the medium and the long run, but people are quite short term in their thinking. So is there an issue about how the media handle this or about education? Because the sort of wise points about what is actually in the people's interests to control expenditure and not to be lashing out money all over the place and to target expenditure, the politicians probably calculate that that isn't getting through as an argument. So,
but
can you explain
it? Is there a point there? Because I remember even just some of, you know, the polling and the survey of, you know, the public in the run up to last year's sort of big record giveaway budget that we weren't really all that sort of grateful for. And, you know, when they're consistently asked, we do want the short fixes.
Yeah, we want everything to be okay over here, but we also, at the end of the day, think about ourselves. And look, the way the government are calculating it is that this is 4 years out from an election. So if you're ever going to pull back, this is the moment to pull back. But they're not willing to pull it back so far that they're not giving people something. Like take the pension argument, right? Every year we have this row over the pension. Is it going to go up 5 euro, 10 euro, 12 euro? I think Labour even suggesting 16 euro. And that becomes this big trade-off. And maybe it is a question for the media, Bobby, but I think it's also a question for the people who vote, if the pension only goes up 5 euro, that will be seen as pensioners left out in the cold. And that's how the reaction will be from all the groups, from all the opposition parties, and that's what the row will become. So the government does feel the pressure to do something to avoid that level of a backlash. So they're trying to do it
Dare I say that some of it comes down to political leadership?
Yeah.
And that actually it is for our elected
to convince
parliamentarians, opposition and government, particularly government, to actually set out the logic and to also be a little bit honest with the public at large in terms of the risks, the headwinds. Everybody is aware of what's happening in geopolitics, global trade, war in Ukraine, tariffs, US president, etc. Everybody is very acutely aware of that. But we have to join up the dots. And the government needs to actually spell out to the public and provide a little bit of leadership in this space. No disrespect, the Irish Independent isn't going to do it for them. You know, no other newspaper is going to do it for them. They've got to do it themselves and make that case.
And on that, we'll take a very quick break. Thank you. You're all very welcome back with me, Erla Sinde-Creighton, Bobby McDonough, Kevin Doyle and Barra Rowntree. Bobby, lots in the papers today. Lucinda, just before the break, was talking about the ever-looming spectre of geopolitics and lots about international diplomacy. Extraordinary scenes in the UN this week, and not just because of escalators that were not functioning.
No, I mean, the UN is a very imperfect organisation, largely because of its decision-making procedures, where five individual countries have a veto. But we're far better having the UN than not having it. It's a place that can put some moral pressure on countries that are behaving very badly and where people can go to express their point of view. And the fact, for example, that Trump denied visas to the Palestinian Authority shows that Trump realises that it's an important forum. I thought that Taoiseach spoke extremely well there. He reminded people why the UN was founded in the first place, which was the Second World War and the Holocaust. And that gave him a sound basis for making very strong criticisms of Israel and the starvation policies. And he also, in parallel with that, made extremely calm criticisms of Russia. And I think it's important to remember the parallel between those two situations, which isn't often emphasised, because they both involve attacking another country. They both involve Russia invading Ukraine and Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinian land. They both involve seizing land that doesn't belong to them. They involve relentless attacks on civilian targets and also war crimes. So I think it's important in the world and in Ireland and elsewhere to avoid hypocrisy. I mean, people who condemn Russia but refuse to condemn and take action against Israel are being hypocritical. But likewise, those who condemn what's happening in Gaza and don't criticise Russia and aren't prepared to give support to Ukraine, they're also being hypocritical.
Just on Russia, and there was a superb piece by Matthew Campbell, I think, in the Sunday Times. What if Putin keeps marching? You know, because these institutions, these mores, these, you know, rules of the internationally order are being stress tested. And is Putin getting much of a pushback?
Well, that was a very speculative piece. And he mentions a particular place in Estonia that might be the first other land that Russia invades. But that's speculative, but it's already happening. I mean, we've had Russian military planes and drones in the last weeks over Poland, Norway, Estonia, Romania and Denmark, including five more in Denmark this weekend. And Russia is on a war footing. And Ireland is vulnerable to cyber attacks. We know Heathrow Airport, for example, was closed down. We're very subject to disinformation. I have no doubt that in the presidential campaign,
and the Sunday Independent in its main story this morning saying we're very vulnerable to drone attacks as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm no doubt that Russia will continue disinformation, not just pro-Russian, but promoting debates about migration and so on, trying to unsettle society. And we have threats to our underwater cables. So there's an immediate onslaught on Ukraine, but there are short-term threats to Estonia and to the countries nearer to Russia. There are also threats to us.
Can I just bring you in there, Lucinda Creighton, a former Minister of State for European Affairs? I was just, the Sunday Times op-ed is kind of looking at the European reliance still on oil and gas. It said that it says, since the start of the Ukraine war, most EU nations, 17 of the 27, have actually paid more into the Russian economy for oil and gas than they have sent in military and financial aid to Ukraine. And I know, obviously, the EU has promised phase that out, but this was not lost on Donald Trump at the UN this week. He said they're funding the war against themselves. Who the hell ever heard of that one?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting one with President Trump, because just because a statement is uttered by him doesn't automatically mean it's wrong, you know. And he's right, incidentally, about the need for Europe to fund and step up to fund its own security and defence. He's absolutely correct. He was right in his first administration and he's right now. And he's also right about that that dichotomy in terms of dependency on Russian energy. And it still exists. I mean, we have de-risked quite a bit since the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, but not sufficiently. the European Union, it has really big plans around, you know, autonomy when it comes to energy supply
security.
And security. Huge plans around green hydrogen, around renewable energy, etc., as does the Irish state. The problem, or at least a problem, there are many problems, but a problem is our inability to build out a grid, to build out interconnectors at a speed, at the sort of pace that we urgently require. So there is a hypocrisy in the fact that many European, almost all EU member states are still dependent on Russia for a large chunk of their energy requirements. And yet at the same time, you know, we are all very conscious of the huge exposure that we have to Russia and our desire to support Ukraine and ensure that ultimately Ukraine is defended and that peace is brought about. So it's a challenge, and I don't see any immediate short term solution other than to ramp up the plans and strategies that already exist.
Our own tree.
Yeah, I mean, another reason why we might need to spend more money and shouldn't be cutting taxes is, but you can come back to this, right? Look, we're, as a country, we're probably at the bottom end of that in terms of capacity. And particularly, I think the worrying one is around our ability to even know what's happening in the skies above us or in the seas around us, right? Our radar system is completely, not at the level it should be. And we also don't have a meaningful naval, service to speak of. And again, so I think when you see this, it is terrifying, right? And we're not at the lines of it, but it feels to me that we're in a very different situation.
Which was not the point, though, of the piece that Matthew Campbell was saying, perhaps not yet, that if Putin keeps pushing and testing, sort of drones or whatever else is happening, that it could be closer.
Absolutely. And again, we have to ask ourselves, well, what do we do if he does invade a European Union country? Are we really going to go, we're neutral? I mean, we might. That just seems completely implausible that we would do this, and we, I think, need to. We were operating in a different, I think, period and frame of mind than a lot of our debate happens in. A lot of our debate happens about kind of, I don't know, neutrality that feels related to the Cold War, rather than necessarily one that's related.
Neutrality used to mean you had no skin in the game. Mm. We have a lot of skin in this game, whether it's energy security or just the well-being of the European Union. So it's quite different now.
If you look at the polling, I mean, the Red Sea have conducted a lot of polling since the invasion of Ukraine, and to me it's really apparent that the Irish public is way ahead of our political class on this, and actually very committed to defending and securing Ireland and Europe, and that's borne out in pretty much all of the polling since February 2022. I think the debate in our Parliament is a little bit behind the curve.
The debate on the golf course has not been very, very polite or nice. Bobby, sport boiling over. It's extraordinary.
And it is, yeah. I mean, the first thing to say is that the European golf team has done extraordinarily well. I'm sure it'll finish off the game today. But I thought the boorishness of the sports fans was completely contrary to any sort of Olympic spirit or the chariots of fire stuff that we believe in when it comes to sport.
And I
believe personally it has something to do with the boorishness of Trump and Trump's America, with his misogyny and xenophobia and the idea that it's us and them, and if you're not supporting our team, you have to oppose the other team.
For anyone who is unaware, state police and extra security were brought in to control abusive fans targeting Rory McIlroy as the Ryder Cup descended into chaos. The organisers were forced to flash up regular messages on giant screens reminding fans to behave, remarks about players' families, and then there were chants of "bad word you Rory," which were sung from the galleries. Are you going to be behaving yourself a little bit better today, Barra,
in Croke Park? Absolutely. Even on that, I think there's...
It is some, shocking.
I know, the golf stuff is shocking, but I mean, that's why golf's such an awful sport, of course. Unlike American football.
It was boring.
But I know, like the NFL game, I think, anyone who's been around Dublin the past week can't have but seen the number of people over, and it is kind of remarkable. Usually I'm very sceptical of the idea that there's any sort of economic boost from hosting sporting occasions. Usually it's just special interest pleading to build an extra stadium or...
Well, we know
whatever.
From concerts and everything else, exactly. Dynamic pricing that...
Yeah, and often it's just displacing activity that's already happening, right? So you get a bunch of people going to a concert when they would have been in Dublin for something else anyway. At this time of year, there's maybe an argument that it's...
And this may be part of the NFL, which is already, huge money. Behemoth might be trying to expand its bottom line by doing these tours. But listen, to behind the scenes, when these big events happen, sporting, cultural or otherwise, there's a lot of business done.
Oh my goodness, yeah, absolutely. So there. I mean, I think from last Monday, there were lots and lots of Americans in town for all sorts of events. I spoke at a law firm event on Thursday. There were lots of the big four advisory firms hosting things. Obviously, the US embassy is at the centre of a lot of this. I was at the Curra race course yesterday for the Goffs Millions race day, and there were loads of people going around in that same top that Barra is wearing here.
So, the correct top.
So
I feel I need to defend the Vikings here.
But there was a great atmosphere all around town. Obviously, hotel prices have gone through the roof. We have a shortage of hotels. That's an issue that Dublin needs to deal with.
But that issue of dynamic pricing is not exclusive to Dublin, presumably.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. But it's not just, it's a supply issue as well, you know. So for the long term interests of our tourism industry, I think there is a shortage of hotels all over the place. But there's a great buzz.
There's a gripe over, I think it's 10 million the government has put up as part of hosting this. And it's amazing. I've been in Dublin several days. I even brought the kids to a Steelers tailgate party yesterday in Merrion Square. The investment around it, they have signs on the Liffey, there's flags all over the place. Dublin looks really well this weekend. And I'm like, I'd be okay if they spent that actually just for me coming into Dublin of a weekend. Never mind that. But that 10 million that they're spending on that versus what we were talking about in a VAT cut, it's the last week of September, the season is over and Dublin is packed and it is flying. And do you know what? It's good fun. I think that's a really good investment that probably will bring, I know it's centric on Dublin and it'll only help the hotels and the restaurants and the pubs in Dublin, but I think they'll get a really good return on investment if seeing is believing, and
it's also a sign of the power of American culture. I mean, I'm by far the oldest person here and that has passed me by, but the idea that everybody around here is so excited in American football rather than in GAA and rugby and soccer, that's not my world.
Maybe they're excited
you can do both.
Maybe they're excited about the prospect of a precedent been set and we might be allowed to take pints at Croke Park. Finally, before we go, Bobby McDonagh, can I ask you just to, there was obituaries and tributes today to the late Martin Mansra in today's papers.
Yeah, well, Martin was a diplomat originally, but he went on to become a senator, a TD and a minister. But he's best known as an advisor in Northern Ireland. He had a unique understanding of the Republican movement, and he was deeply trusted by Haughey and subsequently by Reynolds and Bertie Ahern, and everybody would acknowledge that he was an essential part of the peace process, and he was trusted right across the political spectrum because John Bruton also invited him to work as an advisor. So in my view, and I knew him a bit, I saw him just during the week, he was a good, decent, courteous and consequential public servant.
Yeah, and great fun to spar with in debates. I had the opportunity and the privilege myself in the past. Well, listen, that is all we have time for. My thanks to Lucinda Creighton, to Bobby McDonagh, to Kevin Doyle and to Barrett Rowntree. Enjoy the match this afternoon, but it's just gone 12 o'clock. So let's go to the newsroom.